So what's wrong with campism? In the wake of 9/11, which we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of, inverted commas celebrating, last week, there was intense pressure to bow to the prevailing consensus that military action to stop terrorism was legitimate. The few on the left who opposed the Afghanistan war were denounced as knee-jerk anti-imperialists, dogmatists whose ideological rigidity prevented them from responding concretely to a radically changed world. Those of us who argued that it was incumbent on the left to resist the orgy of militarism that followed 9/11 were voices in the wilderness. But isolated as we were in the dark days of 2001, those who stood their ground and insisted that the left hold on to a clear anti-imperialist position were vindicated many times over in the next few years. By the time of the 2003 invasion of Iraq, tens of millions of people were prepared to take to the streets across the world in what were the biggest anti-war protests, indeed probably the biggest protests of any kind in history. This great global movement was unable to stop the war, but it did give voice to a vital truth, and that was that US militarism was then the key reactionary force in global politics. That was important, but recognition of this fact contained within it all kinds of problems. It led people to downplay the reactionary nature of other imperialist powers, both the major non-Western states, most importantly China and Russia, but also European powers like France and Germany, who refused to back the US invasion for their own narrow reasons. And a focus on US imperialism as the main enemy also tended to obscure another and more fundamental division across the world, the class divide between ordinary people and the ruling elite of each country, and the fact that the antagonisms between the different sections of the latter, the ruling classes, would always, in the final analysis, be subordinated to their common hostility to the social classes that each section of the global elite ruled over. But with those caveats, it was still absolutely right and necessary for the international left to throw what weight it had behind the anti-war movement to champion and try to strengthen its most intransigent anti-imperialist wing. But two developments since, I would argue, have transformed the nature of the tasks facing the left. One, the decline of US power in the wake of the Iraq War and the rise of new centres of imperial power hostile to the US. And two, the reshaping of the terrain of politics brought about primarily by the Arab Revolution of 2011, but also by subsequent uprisings against other regimes which are not aligned with the US bloc. And tragically, I think, the vast bulk of the broad left in the West, which mobilised millions in opposition to the Iraq War, has not been able to rise to the challenge of this new situation. The crucial turning point, in my view, was the Arab Revolutions of 2011. The left, when they first broke out, cheered on revolts, first in Tunisia and then in Egypt. But when they spread to Libya and Syria, the left was thrown into confusion. And the reason for this was the campist politics that dominated the left. And by campist, I mean a politics whereby governments and revolts against them or conflicts between them are judged based on what relationship they have to the US and its allies, what camp each political force is in. So the Arab revolts in Tunisia and Egypt were easy for the campist left to support because they were directed against US allies. Libya and Syria, though, caused immense difficulties because although they were demonstrably driven by the same factors, most importantly, gross inequality and authoritarianism in those countries, Gaddafi and Assad were nominally enemies of the United States and its allies and posed themselves as being anti-imperialist regimes. Now, it's worth noting that assertion that they're anti-imperialist was a pack of lies, but that was the claim. Now, during the war on terror, imperialist intervention was the central factor in the various Middle East conflicts, so the problem with the campus position was not clear. Marxists who stood for working class revolt against their rulers in every country, as we do, could march alongside people whose politics stopped at opposing the US. Now you had a situation where millions of people were rising up against their rulers, regardless of whether those rulers were openly US lackeys, in the case of Mubarak in Egypt, or if they posed as anti-imperialists or defenders of the Palestinians. But the reality was that it was class divisions, not anything to do with imperialism, that were the central antagonism of the Arab Revolution. Yes, of course, as in every revolution or civil war, innumerable other forces tried to turn the situation to their advantage. But the interventions that we saw of imperialist forces, whether that be by the Russians, the US, the Saudis, the Iran or the Israelis, both in 2011 and in subsequent years, did not automatically turn a revolution into a proxy war between great powers. So the attitude of revolutionaries had to be based on the central dynamic of the situation, which was the struggle between the Arab populations and their rulers. You couldn't simply derive a position from looking at the policy of the US ruling class and advocating the opposite. As Trotsky wrote many decades ago, the policy of the proletariat is not at all automatically derived from the policy of the bourgeoisie bearing only the opposite sign. This would make every sectarian a master strategist. No, the Revolutionary Party, Trotsky wrote, must each time orient itself independently in the internal as well as the external situation, arriving at these decisions which correspond best to the interests of the proletariat. Now, at the extreme end of those people who rejected this excellent advice from Trotsky was University of Sydney academic Tim Anderson, who considered and considers the Assad regime to be a secular socialist government that is part of the so-called axis of resistance to US imperialism and Zionism and therefore must be defended at any cost. And for him, the entire revolution was a CIA plot from day one, and the well-documented crimes of the regime are all fabrications concocted by imperialists and their lackeys. And Anderson disgracefully argued in 2016 that the war in Syria has never been a civil war, although there has always been a small minority of Syrians who have engaged in the war, betraying their countries to NATO and the Persian Gulf monarchies, who he said were the ones actually waging the war against the regime. According to Anderson, the crimes of the regime are false flag operations, lies concocted by the opposition. So the 2013 sarin gas attack in Ghouta, which killed as many as 1,500 people, was, according to him and his fellow conspiracy theorists, in fact carried out by the opposition to win international sympathy, similar to what the Americans used to say about Saddam Hussein, making up lies about children dying in Kuwait. That's another thing. Anderson and his ilk also ignore the long history of collaboration of both of the Assad regimes with Israel to keep the peace, as well as Bashar al-Assad's collaboration with George W. Bush during the War on Terror, where they basically took all of America's prisoners to torture them. So there's that sort of element of the campus, but much more common than outright apologists for Assad in this situation were those on the left who acknowledged some or many of the crimes of the regime, but nonetheless argued that the US was still the most culpable party and or that the primary duty of leftists in the West is to oppose our own governments over Syria. For example, in 2016, when Russia launched a savage aerial bombing campaign across Syria to try and save the regime from collapse, which they sadly succeeded in doing, the leaders of the UK Stop the War coalition, while formally opposing Russian bombing, also declared that they do not take sides or have one position on the internal conflict and maintain that the focus of the Western left must be opposing Western intervention. And the Stop the War coalition's stance was justified with reference to the German socialist Karl Liebknecht, who's an iconic hero of the revolutionary movement against World War I, who coined the anti-war slogan, "The main enemy is at home." But the thing is that the context for Liebknecht's heroic stance in 2014 was completely different. When he said that his enemy was his own government and not their imperial rivals, it was not just an assertion of the conflict of interest between German workers, he's German, and their rulers. It was also a powerful statement of solidarity with the workers of Russia, Britain, and the other powers against whom Germany was waging war. And furthermore, when revolution against the Tsar broke out in Russia in 1917, Liebknecht enthusiastically supported it, even though the overthrow of the Tsar was in the narrow short-term interests of the German state. So by the logic of Stop the War, he should have opposed the Russian Revolution on the grounds that it helped German imperialism. Okay, so how does that apply in this situation? Well, if Britain was at war with Russia, I think "the main enemy is at home" would have been a fine slogan for the UK left to raise, one that would not only expose the conflicting class interests in British society, but also promote international sentiments amongst Russian workers and help them resist the jingoistic propaganda of their own rulers. In the Syrian context, though, all raising that slogan did was to say to those resisting Assad, "Well, your enemy is not our enemy, and because you're not fighting our government, well, we don't care. Your plight is not our concern." Now, of course, one way around this would have been to establish that Western governments like the UK, the US and Australia were, in fact, the main immediate enemy of the Syrian people. The only problem with that is that it was probably untrue. There's simply no argument that the US was inflicting death and destruction on Syria on anything like the scale of the Assad regime and its Iranian and Russian allies. And so the logic of the so-called anti-imperialist position led people to constantly play up the atrocities of Western forces and to downplay the much greater level of death and destruction caused by the regime and its allies, which the overwhelming majority of Syrians considered to be their main enemy. And how could they see that as anything other than complete betrayal? Okay, the endlessly asserted point that the US was supplying weapons and other support to the Syrian rebels with a view to helping them overthrow the regime has now been mostly disproven. I don't have time to go into that, but if people don't agree, they can raise it. But actually, if the US had backed the rebels, that would have still been no reason at all for socialists in the West to change their position of support for the revolution. Trotsky dealt with this issue very well in a diplomatically titled 1938 article, which is called Learn to Think, a Friendly Suggestion to Certain Ultra-Lefts. And in that, he said, "Let us assume that the rebellion breaks out tomorrow in the French colony of Algeria under the banner of national independence, and that the Italian government, motivated by its own imperialist interests, prepares to send weapons to the rebels. What should the attitude of the Italian workers be in this case? I've purposely taken an example," Trotsky says, "of rebellion against a democratic imperialism with intervention on the side of the rebels from a fascist imperialism, Mussolini, the ruler of Italy at the time, remember. Should the Italian workers prevent the shipping of arms to the Algerians? Let any ultra-leftist dare to answer this question in the affirmative," Trotsky says. "Every revolutionist, together with the Italian workers and the rebellious Algerians, would spurn such an answer with indignation. Even if a general maritime strike broke out in fascist Italy at the same time, even in this case, the strikers should make an exception in favour of those ships carrying aid to the colonial slaves in revolt. Otherwise, there would be no more than wretched trade unionists, not proletarian revolutionists." And at the same time, Trotsky writes, "the French maritime workers, even though not faced with any strike whatsoever, would be compelled to exert every effort to block the shipment of ammunition intended for the use against the rebels. Only such a policy on the part of the Italian and French workers constitutes the policy of revolutionary internationalism." And I think that's an excellent argument against the whole, approach of so much of the left over the past decade of, trying to prove this, that, and the other about are the Americans backing them? Well, it doesn't matter. If there's a righteous struggle going on, then it's the duty of revolutionaries to stand with that struggle and do everything they can to support it. One thing about that is striking about that long passage from Trotsky is that he was writing in an era when it was commonly assumed, including by the people he was arguing with, that there were many imperial powers. So he's sort of asking if imperial power did A, did this, and imperial power B did that, what should workers in country A and B do? So there's multiple imperial powers. Today, that's not at all accepted on the left internationally. Imperialism, according to the prevailing view, simply means US imperialism. Now, the reality of the Iraq War, obviously, where the US was the dominant imperial power and the main enemy of humanity, played a role, doubtless, in establishing this idea. And so, too, does the ongoing reality of that the US remains the biggest and the most belligerent of the imperial powers. But it only became so deep-rooted, this idea, because of the politics, I would argue, of Stalinism and their ongoing currency on the broad left. I think to understand this, you need to understand some of the history of how Stalinism distorted Marxism, transforming it from a theory of working class insurrection on a global scale into a politics of supporting, one set of rulers over another. There's only a few people on the left today who are willing to openly argue that the model for socialism is authoritarian dictatorship, although in the last few years we have actually seen, I think, connected closely to the Bernie Sanders movement in America, both its supporters and also sort of left critics, we have seen a rise of the numbers of people who, openly want to support and say, that countries like China and so on are actually socialist. But, that's, I don't think, anything like majority opinion on the left. But the legacy of Stalinism runs much deeper than that. Stalinism infected almost every aspect of politics on the broad left, well beyond the communist parties. You're talking about the people in the Labor Party and so on, or just the broad left sort of sensibilities about what left and right politics is, have been heavily impacted by the domination of Stalinism for so many decades. From the mid-1920s onwards, a key part of Stalin's consolidation of power involved transforming Marxism as a theory from a weapon of revolutionary change into an ideological structure structure that would legitimize Stalin's counter-revolution in Russia and justify Russian policy internationally. And I think that those sort of ideological legacies are, in a way, much more long-lasting than, you know, people's support for the USSR or whatever. It started with the slogan of socialism in one country, which effectively abandoned the idea that the working class, that working class liberation could only happen on an international scale. Then came the theory of the Popular Front, which rejected the idea that the working class had to maintain its independence from other social classes and fight for its own interests. In the mid-1930s, what this Popular Front meant was trying to win support for Stalin's foreign policy from any possible quarter, and in particular from the ruling classes of other countries, including the most powerful imperialist countries in the world, France and and Britain. After World War II, though, Stalinism evolved even further away from any conception of working-class self-emancipation. Immediately after the war, communist parties in countries like France and Italy entered bourgeois governments. Now, after 1947, with the onset of the Cold War, the communists in the West once again became isolated from the political mainstream. But instead of turning back to the rhetoric of class struggle, as they had in the third period, the start of the 30s, they posed their arguments in terms of the struggle against imperialism. In Asia, this meant armed guerrilla war in countries like Burma, Malaya, Indonesia, China, Vietnam, India, and the Philippines. In the West, particularly in Western Europe and Australia, this period saw the first stages of the so-called peace movement, which led to the formation of the World Peace Council in 1950. And this development was to decisively shift the ideological outlook of the international communist movement away from class struggle and towards a class collaborationist or even outright middle-class orientation. And after Stalin's death, this process accelerated. In 1953, Russia announced that it had successfully manufactured a hydrogen bomb. So the first move away from an orientation to worker struggle as a means to advance Russian foreign policy in the West had occurred when the USSR imposed the Popular Front strategy, forming alliances with bourgeois governments. The entry of the USSR into the arms race, the nuclear arms race, reinforced this trend, as Ian Birchall, a British Marxist, put it. He said, from now on, it was clear that the defence of Russia did not depend on the international communist movement. It depended on the Russian nuclear defence system keeping pace with the Americans. And paradoxically, the entry of the USSR into the nuclear race coincided with the renewed stress on the idea of peaceful coexistence. Okay, so the acquisition of the bomb and the Popular Front policy had removed the working class from any agency in the struggle against world capitalism. And now peaceful coexistence, which is really the ideological child of socialism in one country, signalled that the Russian state had no interest in the radical transformation of the world order, but was instead concerned simply to maintain its place in that order. Class politics had given way completely to state diplomacy, and that state and that diplomacy was directed at maintaining the status quo. Now, this last factor was a vital element in explaining the Sino-Soviet split between Russia and China in 1960-61, and also the appeal of the new Maoist parties that emerged in the 1960s. Whereas Russia had, since the Yalta Conference in 1945, succeeded in establishing itself as a great power, China was still underdeveloped and battling to improve its position. And this explains much more assertive, combative nature of Chinese foreign policy and rhetoric. But Maoism, based as it was on a nationalist state bourgeoisie that came to power without any involvement of working class forces, did not abandon the underlying politics of Stalinism at all. And while more aggressively hostile to the US up to the early 1970s at least, it rejected any orientation to working class struggle, substituting in its place a range of strategies from guerrilla struggle and nuclear armament to state diplomacy. In the West, the communist parties increasingly moved away from being creatures of Russian foreign policy and became integrated into the institutions of their own national states. So all of these developments together, and sorry, a bit of a Cook's tour, all of these developments together reinforced the increasing disconnect between the idea of socialism and working class struggle. And this had huge implications for the way the left as a whole, going well beyond the actual communist parties, but anyone who saw themselves as sort of left-wing, viewed its relationship to class. Now, prior to Marx, the concept of socialism had no single class identification. At the core of the ideological and political battles waged by Marx through his lifetime was the attempt to transform socialism from a utopian ideology into the worldview and the theoretical tool of the working classes. How Draper put it, historical materialism or Marxism, as conceived by Marx, was the theory and the practice of the proletarian revolution. And in the period between the rise of the Second International in the 1880s, the first mass socialist organisation or international organisation, between then and the Stalinisation of the communist movement in the late 1920s, the idea of socialism was synonymous with a movement of one particular class, the working class. And just listen here to what is written in the Erfurt programme, criticised by revolutionaries, but nonetheless, which was adopted by the German Social Democratic Party in 1891. In many ways, it was the founding document of the European socialist movement. This is what it said. This social transformation, the abolition of capitalism, amounts to the emancipation not only of the proletariat, but of the entire human race, which is suffering from current conditions. But it can only be the work of the working class, because all other classes, notwithstanding the conflicts of interest between them, stand on the ground of private ownership with the means of production and have as their common goal the preservation of the foundations of contemporary society. It is the task of the Social Democratic Party to shape the struggle of the working class into a conscious and unified one and to point out the inherent necessity of its goals. So this class connection between socialism and the working class did not simply operate at the level of theory. Prior to Stalinisation, the leaders and the heroes of the Marxist movement were intimately associated with the working class struggle. Its icons were people like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, James Connolly, Joe Hill, Eleanor Marx, August Babel, and Bill Haywood. In Australia, figures like Tom Mann and Percy Brookfield were both union militants and the leaders of socialist organisations. Even for socialists who did not come from working class backgrounds themselves, being won to socialism meant becoming a partisan of the working class struggle. There were, of course, intellectual figures in this period, from Engels, Lenin and Luxembourg, Kautsky and Plekhanov, but they as well were intimately connected to the workers' movement, and those who abandoned that movement were, in doing so, seen to be abandoning socialism itself. Under Stalinism, though, the heroes of socialism were the leaders of states, guerrilla figures, fighters in the hills, parliamentarians, middle-class intellectuals. Socialism stopped being about class and simply became an ideological label. The leading socialists in the public eye during the middle of the 20th century were, aside from Stalin himself, people like Mao, Che Guevara, Castro, Ho Chi Minh, and so on. And even those who were leaders of working class parties or trade union leaders were, for the most part, by dint of the reformist class collaborationist politics of Stalinism, increasingly distant from workers' concerns, little different from the middle-class social democratic politicians who spent their time hobnobbing with a political establishment and only on rare occasions condescending to address a meeting of workers or a rally. Okay, so this process of transforming socialism from a working-class movement into an ideological label that can be just sort of stuck on or fixed to any old leader of a state also lays the basis for transforming the conception of imperialism. Imperialism, in that circumstance, stops being the way you understand the competition between rival capitalist states and blocs and simply becomes what the people who don't call themselves socialists do. In the context of the Cold War and US hegemony in the decades after it, imperialism came to mean, or to just mean, US imperialism. Now, we are today in a new era of imperialism, so we do need an anti-imperialist left desperately. But that left needs to base itself on an understanding of what imperialism actually is, the struggle between rival capitalists who each rule over their own working class and oppress and exploit them. Anti-imperialist politics is about opposing our own imperialists, but it's just as much about supporting workers' rebellion and democratic uprisings wherever they occur. Now, we know, of course, that our rulers will cynically use repression in states they oppose to pursue their own aims. We saw that with the Hong Kong rebellion last year. But Marxism is a politics of rebellion against all oppression, not just our own. When our rulers point to the atrocities of the Chinese ruling class, our response should not be to invent excuses for the Chinese regime or accuse those resisting them of being US puppets, but to attack the hypocrisy of our right-wing politicians who claim to support freedom and justice abroad, but oppose it here at home. So every rebellion against the system, from the US to Russia, Hong Kong, China, Egypt, Mexico, Syria, Libya, Belarus, the UK, wherever else, is a part of our struggle. For the socialist movement to truly become a movement that unites all of the workers of the world, we need to defeat the politics of campism, politics which denies solidarity to workers who live under governments that our rulers, for whatever reasons of their own, don't like. I'll finish there.